limit and neutralize Hashd al-Sha'bi's activities with full respect. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy made this decision to get rid of Al-Rafidain Lions in Iraq.
The Dark Room.
Introduction of Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy is based in Washington, D.C. This institute is a kilometer away from the White House. It is called the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This institute was established in 1985. Its mission statement says that it seeks to advance American interests in West Asia. Who is Martin Indyk? He's Jewish. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was the former research assistant in American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to Israeli regime for two terms, articulated the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq.
Israel is getting the benefit of that growing recognition and acceptance in the Arab world, which started with Egypt and the Israel-Egypt peace treaty and has advanced all of this time in which we've been talking about the travails with the Palestinians, the relations with the Arab states grown and developed.
Martin Indyk is a British-born Jew who is now an American citizen. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy to serve American interests and policies in West Asia. He is the only non-American to have reached the rank of ambassador. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to the Israeli regime for two terms, serving the United States and Israel at the same time. He's a member of the U.S. National Security Council. He received confidence vote from both main U.S. parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. He was also a key member in Camp David Accords. He has dedicated a 40-year effort to paving the way for peace and reconciliation in West Asia, and he makes it as clear as possible that over the past 40 years, he has been absolutely convinced that compromise or peace is possible in West Asia.
For 35 years, I've been essentially devoted my life to trying to achieve a secure peace for Israel.
Martin Indyk introduced the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq. He believed in the theory of dual containment during the presidency of Bill Clinton. According to this theory, in order to serve the interests of Israel, they had to build an economic and technological fence to change the governments in Iraq and Iran so that the countries of the region would not follow them.
I think makes them very nervous, and that's why the Prime Minister is coming out much more vocally than one might have expected in the midst of an election campaign here. Saying, you know, we need reassurances, we need red lines against the Iranians, because from his point of view, that's the greatest threat they face.
Now, and after the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy advises its policymakers to either consider introducing a new leader
far from Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis's ideas or dissolving Hashd al-Sha'bi. Another suggestion is to focus on limiting its organization and filling the vacancy of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis with a person based on their taste. Of course, the group's patience for achieving their goals is so great that the founder of this think tank spent 35 years of his life realizing the idea of creating Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates.
I went back into government to work with Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama again to try to negotiate a final status agreement for the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. So it was a kind of continuation of that effort, a continuation of 35 years of obsession on my part with trying to find a way to achieve a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Michael Knights is another Washington think tank expert who is known for his occasional travels to Iraq. He had previously said that they need someone like General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq to unite their forces and integrate and use all the instruments of their national power. From the Washington Institute's point of view, now is the time for the unification of American forces after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, provided that Hashd al-Sha'bi would be contained and weakened shortly and dissolved and surrendered at a future date. Hashd al-Sha'bi is currently based on a reasonably weak organizational framework and consists of less than 20 pages of law related to public, general executive orders issued to people, and cabinet decisions. This view will change if the Iraqi government implements existing laws and regulations, such as Military Service and Retirement Law No. 3 of 2010 or the Military Penal Code No. 19 of 2007. The Sha'bi forces must be respectfully contained. In the second step of the scenario, this group must be stripped of its spiritual identity and replace livelihood with religious laws and religion. In the Washington Institute version, membership in Hashd al-Sha'bi with certain rights is the key to monitoring a Rafidin lions. Until the membership of Hashd is defined, fixed, and transparent, any audit of the behavior of its member will be difficult. If and when comprehensive audits are undertaken, they must be done by an independent body, not the Hashd itself. Hashd al-Sha'bi's three operational units, including local units, units stationed in southern Iraq, and finally, wandering units, must not comment negatively about the occupation, and this is to contain Hashd al-Sha'bi respectfully. leadership acts like a parallel state. It runs a parallel judicial system and prisons, a parallel illicit economy, and a parallel war effort that undermines unity of command across the entire Iraqi security forces. The Washington think tank strategy is to stop growing power of Hashd al-Sha'bi in the first place in order to mobilize all elements of power in Iraq, including the government and authority against them. The think tank's final goal is to create a united front against the existence of Hashd al-Sha'bi, including all the countries that have interests in Iraq. Of course, it takes about 5 to 10 years to realize this idea. Firstly, Hashd al-Sha'bi's growing power must be stopped. At this stage, Hashd al-Sha'bi's activities, its budget and institutional infrastructure are still limited, and they must stay at the same level. Undoubtedly, the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis provided an opportunity in this case. This opportunity was realized by concentrating too much power among a limited number of commanders of Hashd al-Sha'bi, provided that the Iraqi government, Islamic seminaries, and international powers come together. Although the plan of Hashd al-Sha'bi's respectful restraint is defined in the long run, but it tries to seize the opportunities. According to the plan, it would be preferable to start the operation by changing the form and structure, first by changing the logo of Hashd al-Sha'bi. Afterwards, a hero approved by the government and the authority is introduced and supported as the new leadership of Hashd al-Sha'bi. Finally, the plan suggests the integration of Hashd al-Sha'bi units, so there will be changes in the structure of the popular mobilization units. So they would just play the role of a unit defending one of the small holy places. In this way, Hashd al-Sha'bi will be respected and its identity will be emptied. Start your work by changing the structure and form. In the first step, start changing Hashd al-Sha'bi's logo with a foreign version. Then, activate and strengthen a reform hero with the support of the Iraqi Prime Minister and the Islamic Seminary. The chosen hero must be popular and courageous, and his relationship with religious institutions must probably be beyond criticism. Talking about security, they have to design a single organizational logo for tactical units, integrate small and large units of Hashd al-Sha'bi into light infantry units, and integrate heavy weapons into sections with dedicated and secure warehouses. By considering a convincing argument beyond the idea, it would be great in 10 years to have forces like a parallel national force, similar to Basij in Iran, to protect sacred shrines that will be partially or completely mobilized at all times. If we consider the influential figures in the history of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and review the approach of the Institute's expert advisors, we come to understand that all of these political, military, and media figures pursue a common goal, which is preserving U.S. and Israeli interests in dominating West Asia.
Henry Kissinger has been a friend of mine. I've liked him, I've respected him, but we've been friends for a long time, long before my emergency.
Henry Kissinger, Jewish, former U.S. Secretary of State under Richard Nixon and convicted of war crimes. Robert Satloff, the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, specialist in the Arab and Islamic world, and the only non-Arab presenter of the American network, Al Hurra in Iraq. Warren Christopher, Deputy Secretary of State under President Jimmy Carter, Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, private investigator of Arab-Israeli Peace Project. Alexander Haig, NATO Supreme Allied Commander under President Richard Nixon, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan.
I'm deeply grateful, Mr. President.
Robert McFarlane, U.S. Marine Corps Officer, National Security Advisor to President of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Arabs looking at Iraq could
see... Richard Perle, Member of Senate Armed Services Committee, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs under President Ronald Reagan, known as American Dracula, one of the main motivators of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
I do think there's probably a new look...
Dennis Ross, U.S. Representative in the Middle East peace process under President George W. Bush, and President Bill Clinton, Special Assistant to President Barack Obama, Special Advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
By several facts, and fact number one...
Paul Wolfowitz, the 10th President of the World Bank, Assistant Secretary of State under Bush and Reagan, architect of the U.S. war against Iraq. Will the strategy of this apex resource in eliminating Hashd al-Sha'bi be able to realize the Zionist dream of 70 years to form a greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates? Actually, this time starting from the Euphrates. Our Rafidein lions seem to be quite vigilant in the face of Israeli plans.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight.
The data on the advertising expenses of 25 major oil and gas producing companies, oil industry lobby groups, and pro-industry groups shows that They have started a huge advertising campaign to promote fossil fuels as much as possible since the candidacy of Joe Biden for U.S. presidency. Also, environmental activists and critics of these oil giants say that these companies deceptively are trying to show themselves as supporters of green energy with the help of large advertising lobbies. But behind the scenes, they're trying to confuse public opinion about the activities to achieve green and clean energy. We'll now take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian writes, criticism in the US of the oil industry's obfuscation over the climate crisis is intensifying after internal documents showed companies attempted to distance themselves from agreed climate goals, admitted gaslighting the public over efforts to go green, and even wished critical activists be infested by bedbugs. The communications were unveiled as part of a congressional hearing held in Washington, D.C., where an investigation into the role of fossil fuels in driving the climate crisis produced documents obtained from the oil giants ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and British Petroleum, BP. Varshini Prakash, executive director of Sunrise, said, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they wish bedbugs on you, then you win." The organization accused Shell of a legacy of violence and of ignoring the well-being of communities across the globe. The revelations are part of the third hearing held by the U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Reform on how the fossil fuel industry sought to hamper the effort to address the climate crisis. Democrats who lead the committee called top executives from the oil companies to testify last year, in which they denied they had misled the public. Richard Wiles, president of the Center for Climate Integrity, said the new documents are the latest evidence that oil giants keep lying about their commitments to help solve the climate crisis and should never be trusted by policymakers. Richard Wiles added, "If there is one thing consistent about the oil and gas majors' position on climate, it's their utter inability to tell the truth." Rohana, co-chair of the committee, said the new documents are explosive and show a culture of intense disrespect to climate activists. He said the oil giants' climate pledges rely on unproven technology, accounting gimmicks, and misleading language to hide the reality. "Big oil executives are laughing at the people trying to protect our planet while they knowingly work to destroy it." BalkanGreenEnergyNews.com explains more about the same story. The new Influence Map report shows that the five largest oil companies continue to disseminate disinformation to present themselves to the public as environmentally responsible companies, while at the same time lobbying the decision-makers for fossil fuels continuously. The report reveals a systematic mismatch between green public communication and lobbying activities. The Influence Map report reveals that the so-called big oil companies, that is BP, Shell, Chevron, ExxonMobil and Total Energies, are conducting a spread of disinformation to present an environmentally responsible public image while continuously lobbying governments and decision makers to ensure that countries remain locked on fossil fuels for decades to come. A new study shows that big oil companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars on climate-responsive messages to create a positive image in climate campaigns. However, companies continue to invest in oil and gas. According to the analysis, the forecasted oil production by big oil companies is not in line with the International Energy Agency's zero-emission plans for 2050, while several of these companies plan to expand oil and gas production through to 2026. Also, none of the oil majors lobbied for strengthening regulations for stricter methane emissions, despite the importance of methane mitigation being a key claim in the fossil fuel industry. Influence Map found that none of the companies have aligned their climate policy engagement activities with the goals of the Paris Climate Accord. The website carbonbrief.org sheds more light on the same issue. A new study says four of the world's largest oil and gas companies are failing to back their words and pledges on climate change with genuine action and genuine investment. Mentions of climate change and low carbon energy have roughly tripled in annual reports from Chevron, from ExxonMobil, BP and Shell over the past decade. But even as these firms issue pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions and invest in renewable energies, the study concludes that such a transition is simply not occurring, as all four companies continue to focus primarily on producing fossil fuels. The study published in PLOS ONE comes in the wake of record profits for fossil fuel industry as a global energy crisis bumps up oil and gas prices. In Britain, BP has argued against an additional windfall tax in response to the crisis, partly on the basis that it would hamper the firm's planned low-carbon investments. However, having analysed how the four companies' commitments align with their climate action and spending, the authors of the new study questioned the extent of these investments. The study concludes while their oil and gas production has remained consistently high, less than 1% of their capital investment went into low-carbon technology between 2010 and 2018. An expert who was not involved in the new research tells carbonbrief.org that it provides robust evidence that fossil fuel companies are not walking the talk when it comes to addressing climate change. Due to the use of their products, Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP and Shell are associated with globally significant shares of greenhouse gas emissions. By one estimate, they are responsible for more than one-tenth of all CO2 emissions that has been emitted since 1965. Amid growing societal and political pressures, these companies have started pledging to cut emissions, even committed to net zero emission targets, although in some cases only for their operations rather than their products. BP has said it intends to move away from oil to become an integrated energy company. However, previous studies have extensively documented how oil majors have spread misinformation about climate change, spent millions of dollars lobbying against climate measures, and shifted the blame for global warming onto consumers. The researchers write in their new study, "This historical behavior suggests that the authenticity of the company's climate commitments should be examined critically and exhaustively."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the last day of September, Burkina Faso military leader President Paul-Henri Damiba was deposed in the country's second coup in a year as Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré took charge of the restive West African nation. Now, the coup was welcomed by many in the streets of the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We are in the streets not because we support a coup or encourage it, but to find unity and truth. We are here to support our military, to find peace, because we have suffered so much at the hands of terrorists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the recent coup in Burkina Faso, which came amid an upsurge of terrorist attacks. The people of Burkina Faso, just like many in neighboring West African countries, believe that former colonial power France is responsible for the current insecurity across the region. Our expert will be giving us her take on the reasons for the coup in Burkina Faso. The second part of our program today will be on condescending remarks by the United States climate envoy John Kerry, who is demanding that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects.
The struggle in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré has ousted military leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba in what marks the second coup in the West African country this year. According to a statement read on national TV on 30th of September, Traoré and a group of officers deposed Damiba, dissolved the government, and suspended the constitution and transitional charter.
Traoré said the officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided to remove their leader due to his inability to deal with the insurgent groups, including some associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh. A Burkina Faso military spokesman is seen here making the coup announcement.
Our common ideal was betrayed by our leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba, in whom we had placed all our trust. Indeed, the deterioration of the security situation, which justified our action, has been relegated to the background in favor of unfortunate political adventures.
Well, to discuss the recent military coup in Burkina Faso, we contacted Ms. Inem Richardson. She's an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to be on.
Now, what really led to the latest coup in Burkina Faso just months after another military takeover?
Well, I think if we look at the context behind this coup and the last one, we see that the original coup against Damiba was actually quite popular at first. People came out largely in support of it, because the hope was that Damiba would follow the direction that Mali took and divorce Burkina Faso from France and French domination, as well as from Western control in general. That was very much the desire of the people on the ground and why people wanted the coup in the first place. After a long period of time, people began to see that there was not much of a difference in terms of how France's relationship with Burkina Faso materialized or existed on the ground, as well as how the Damiba administration was approaching the security situation in the Sahel region and the border region with Mali. So there was an increased, over time, discontent with Damiba.
The dramatic takeover, which ended with ousted military leader fleeing to neighboring Togo, coincided with violent anti-French protests and the sudden emergence of Russian flags among demonstrators. The army officers who seized power in Burkina Faso say toppled military leader Paul Henri Damiba is planning a counter-offensive from a French base. Protesters have come out in support of the new military leader, while condemning the ousted ruler, who they accused of being a puppet of France.
Damiba is pro-French. He has destroyed Burkina Faso. But thanks to God, we have a great strong man like Ibrahim Traoré to save us all.
Protesters in Burkina Faso have openly expressed support for Russia. Burkina Faso is now turning into a theater of struggle for control between Russia and France and the West in general.
I think, you know, Burkina Faso and this whole region of the Sahel in general is beyond a theater of struggle between Russia and the West, I think this is also a region where there's a heightened dissatisfaction with a long neocolonial system that has been run by France and French allies like the United States and the other NATO countries for a very, very long time. So we see not just here in Burkina Faso, but also we've mentioned Mali, but we can talk about Chad. We can talk about protests in Niger. We can even talk about protests in Senegal. We see this whole movement trying to get France out of the Sahel.
Now, we have seen protesters expressing displeasure with the regional bloc ECOWAS after military takeovers in West Africa. Now, is ECOWAS realistic in its approach to coups in the region?
I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy within ECOWAS right now. We understand that the goal of ECOWAS and what it promotes are what they claim to be free and fair elections, a certain style of democracy that is encouraged in the region. But we also see some of these people who are taking the most anti-coup stances, like out of Senegal and out of Cote d'Ivoire, for example, who are also constantly under surveillance by the people themselves because of this constant threat of taking illegal third mandates, unconstitutional third mandates, to stay in power and to prolong their own positions. So there's kind of this hypocrisy where, on the one hand, ECOWAS is very pro sort of this Western-style bourgeois democracy, but on the other hand, also violates that whenever it's convenient for certain neocolonial factors to stay in power. What is really damaging on ECOWAS's part are when the sanctions are issued in cases like what happened against Mali, because that's not even just targeting the Malian government. That's hurting the people.
The recent events in Burkina Faso are almost similar to what happened in neighboring Mali, where anti-French sentiments run high. The government in Mali believes France is still interfering in the internal affairs of this country, including backing terrorist groups.
I really encourage everybody who is listening to this to go and listen to what Prime Minister Maiga said at the United Nations General Assembly. The accusations against France by the Malian authorities are really quite grave, really quite serious. Beyond just supporting the former president of Mali, we are hearing about the violation of Malian airspace with drones and fighter jets. We are hearing accusations that France has supplied terrorist organizations with arms and ammunition, as well as intelligence information. There was support on France's part of ECOWAS sanctions against Mali as a result of the anti-French government that's currently in power and currently seized power.
According to the Global Terrorism Index 2022, the Sahel is home to the world's fastest growing and most deadly terrorist groups. Now, how will the instability in Burkina Faso impact on the regional struggle against terrorism in the wider Sahel region?
Well, I think more and more people are understanding that this question of terrorism and this question of neocolonialism are not separate questions, but we have to understand what the roots are of terrorist activity is in this region of the world. I already mentioned the way that the NATO invasion of Libya impacted the Sahel. That led to a huge availability of arms flowing into the direction of the Sahel region. And this is something that people are increasingly aware of. And then, we are talking about the role of France in also helping to sustain some of this terrorist activity, according to what the Malian authorities are currently alleging. And so I think that, there's different ways to look at this question. Stability, we see this as typically a positive thing, but we have to understand that, stability is not always necessarily positive. If it's necessary to disrupt the system that exists a little bit for a period of time, if that means some form of instability, as long as we can bring that to a place of organization and to a popular form of government, then that's welcome. But what's not welcome is a very stable, long-term neocolonial system that completely exploits the African people for the benefit of France and for the benefit of Europe.
Well, our guest there says instability, which ushers in a popular government, is preferable than a stable neo-colonial system. I'd like to thank Inem Richardson for her incisive analysis today. We shall now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the patronizing remarks by the U.S. climate envoy, which angered many in Africa. Stay with us.
Kerry angers Africa. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States climate envoy John Kerry has angered many in Africa after arrogantly stating that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects in the continent. Speaking on the sidelines of an African government ministers' conference in Dakar, Senegal last month, Kerry claimed the world is transitioning to renewable energy and that will not be in the interest of Africa investing in gas projects.
Gas replaces coal or replaces oil. That's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas, too.
Now, to discuss these annoying remarks by John Kerry, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, who is an African team member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can we say the assertion by Kerry that Africa should not invest in long-term gas projects is condescending and imperialistic?
I think so. Especially since Kerry is representing the U.S. imperialist state. U.S. imperialism is the greatest threat to life on the planet. It's a force of ecological devastation and disaster. It impacts not only human beings, but also our non-human neighbors and relatives. In fact, you know, the U.S. military is the largest force of ecological devastation that the world has ever known. It's, you know, been robbed through atomic bombs, toxic waste, and untreated sewage that's been dumped by over 800 military bases in over 80 countries. The U.S. Department of Defense actually consumes more oil than any institution in the world. And in the year 2017 alone, the U.S. military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is a carbon footprint greater than of most nations worldwide.
Mohammed Ibrahim, a leading African philanthropist, accused developed countries of hypocrisy in warning Africans against developing natural gas reserves while also eyeing such investments in response to the energy crisis in Europe.
Europe is wallowing in gas. Germany uses a lot of gas. Russian gas, actually half of African gas is exported to Europe. And then we have 600 million people without power. And people say, no. You cannot use gas here. This is morally bankrupt. It's just, that's immoral.
Many African analysts have echoed Mohammed Ibrahim's sentiments, saying efforts by Western powers to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa are the height of hypocrisy.
It's the height of hypocrisy, those efforts to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa, since many of the wealthy countries behind those efforts, like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, include natural gas in their own multi-decade plans to transition to clean energy. Belgium, for example, has doubled its natural gas usage since 1990 and has plans to build even more gas-to-power capacity in the coming years.
While Africa has contributed negligibly to the changing climate with just about 2-3% of global emissions, it stands out disproportionately as the most vulnerable region in the world. Now, this is while, according to Carbon Brief's analysis, the United States is the highest contributor to cumulative carbon dioxide emissions in the world since 1850. Now, Kerry denied that the West and developed nations bear responsibility for climate change and urged every country to bear the burden of its impacts. How true is this statement?
It's not very true. The African continent and much of the third world is already bearing the brunt of climate change, while much of the West, is relatively protected in some cases, right? And the African continent hardly produces any greenhouse gases, despite all of that. African people and Africa's non-human inhabitants are paying a heavy price for the environmental crimes of foreign lands like the U.S., like, you know, France and the U.K. and Japan and others. One resident of the United States has the same climate footprint as 27.5 Senegalese people.
The West is insisting that Africa forgoes the gas, oil, and coal at its disposal due to climate change. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni, speaking recently at the country's independence celebrations, slammed European Union Parliament for demanding that the country should halt its East Africa crude oil pipeline project.
Recently, there was yet another manifestation of imperialistic arrogance and hegemonism by elements in the European Parliament, whereby they decreed from Brussels that East African crude pipeline should not be constructed until those arrogant actors permit us to do so.
The insistence by U.S. climate envoy John Kerry and the EU Parliament that African countries should halt their fossil fuel development projects is seen by many as a deliberate attempt by Western countries to prevent Africa's industrialization, which will eventually stop over-reliance to the West.
I think we should note that it's not just industrialization that caused climate change. It's really the extractive practices of multinational corporations, largely based in the West, and the devastation of, you know, Western militaries, in particular those like the U.S. military, that brought about climate change. And so the false narrative that, you know, the West is trying to push helps them argue that Africa and a lot of the third world should forgo industrialization. And that's basically a death sentence for African countries.
Delegates from over 50 countries participated in a pre-COP27 meeting held in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Climate activists praised the progress made and want to make sure that previous promises are kept. The country's environment minister said that Africa must be allowed to exploit its resources.
The 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, more commonly referred to as the COP27 Summit, will be held at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, in November. Now, what's your projection on this meeting? Are we going to see major split between the West and Africa?
And the success of that domination has always depended on the complicity of an intermediate class of the colonized. Those forces represent a central pillar of the colonial order. They're really just servants to, you know, their imperialists or neocolonial masters. And so for that to change, there has to be some sort of serious class struggle on the African continent against these servants we call, you know, heads of state or and their contemporaries, the compradors, the African ruling class. And I think without that class struggle, there won't be a major split at the COP27 summit. There'll only be minor statements of grievance, like we're seeing, you know, today with certain folks kind of speaking out.
Now, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has expressed readiness to work with other willing partners in the country's oil pipeline project after the European Union expressed opposition to the development of the country's oil resources. Let's take a listen.
East Africa, therefore, should not worry about those arrogant people, that those arrogant people can stop the oil project in East Africa. If any actor tries to delay our project, we shall decisively deal with that betrayal according to the relevant laws. We shall develop all the aspects of the project with willing partners. Initially, I was not interested in the pipeline. I was only interested in the refinery to produce petrol, diesel, aviation fuel for East African market. It is Total who insisted, even when Uganda had to give away US dollars 20.7 per barrel to use the pipeline. In the end, we support the pipeline because it contributes something modest to our Tanzanian sisters and brothers who, under Mwalimu's leadership, contributed so much to Africa, including Uganda, in the anti-colonialism effort. Besides, the pipeline corridor provided by the Tanzanian government will bring to us gas from Tanzania and Mozambique because our gas resources are not that big. We need gas for fertilizer manufacture, to produce chemicals, etc. Therefore, down with the imperialist parasitic meddlers.
Now, what option do African countries have if Western oil multinationals and financial institutions withdraw from fossil energy projects in Africa?
Western oil multinationals and, you know, the international or Western financial institutions are largely responsible for the current climate catastrophe that Africa and much of the colonized world is experiencing. What African countries need is debt cancellation, they need debt cancellation and reparations for the decades, even, you know, centuries of work that these institutions and corporations have done to impoverish African people and intensify that climate catastrophe that they're facing at this moment on the African continent and really throughout the world.
Well, there you have it. Western colonial powers actually owe African countries billions of dollars for crimes they committed against African people over the past centuries. This is the money that Africa needs to develop and attain self-sufficiency. I'd like to thank our guest today, Tunde Osazua, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Acts of violence and vandalism by Israeli settlers targeting Palestinian properties are routine in the West Bank throughout the year. Reports of acts of violence and vandalism against Palestinians are also rarely prosecuted by the Zionist regime forces. Olive trees are an indispensable source of revenue for many Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank, and acts of vandalism are a deliberate attempt to stifle their means of income. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. In this regard, Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The olive harvest season in Palestine has started. For Palestinians, the olive harvest is not just important for the local economy, but is a national event expressing unity, social cohesion, and defiance of the Israeli regime occupation. The Zionist regime often erases ancient olive groves in the occupied Palestinian territories to build illegal Jewish settlements, confiscate Palestinian land for whatever military purpose, or simply break the spirit of ordinary Palestinians. This is why the olive harvest is an important Palestinian occasion to send a message back to the Zionist regime that the relationship with their land is as strong as ever."